Today I'm talking to Felix Ahlers, CEO of Froster, a European frozen food company. This is not the story of a high-end specialty food startup. Rather, it's about an industrial food processor who underwent a fundamental change in what it understood to be its mission and how it needs to act on it. A mission that could be summarized as providing wholesome nutrition by using only natural ingredients and preparing the dishes the way grandma would. As you will hear, acting on this mission came at a cost and not necessarily to the consumers. But we think it's a story of hope. Hope for all those traditional manufacturers out there that are struggling to adjust their offerings and brands to people's increasing desire for a wholesome lifestyle and a healthy environment. Enjoy.
Please listen carefully.
Hello and welcome everyone to this new episode of the Überbrands podcast. The podcast in which we discuss brands that are desired beyond price, performance, or even reason. Brands that seduce rather than sell, that add some myth to the material and shine from the inside out. We call them Überbrands, and we, that is your host, JP Kühlwein, and occasional co-host, Wolf Schaefer. And today I'm delighted to welcome Felix Ahlers. Felix is the CEO and chairman of a company called Froster AG, which is also a brand from Germany. Thanks so much, Felix, for taking time to come on the show.
Yeah, sure. Hello.
Felix, some of our listeners will not know about Froster. It's a pre-made food brand in the European market. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of Froster and how you came to join that brand?
Yeah, sure. Froster was founded in the 60s in the small harbor town of Bremerhaven, Germany. And initially, it was a company that was working only on fresh fish. And then my father, who started the company, realized that fresh fish is not always very fresh when it comes to the final consumer. So he started frozen food, and initially with frozen fish. That was a big beginning. Then we started to move into ready meals and also vegetables. And I joined in about 1999, 2000, and I'm now in charge of the company.
And you have an interesting background. You went to study, I think, in Paris, but as well as in the United States. I think you did an MBA there. And you trained as a chef, if I got that right. You ran a hotel. What made you join the company? And then what was it like when you joined? Did you like what you see?
Yeah, I liked actually, as a young boy, I liked always cooking. I don't really know why, because it's not really from the family. My father was not very enthusiastic about cooking, but I liked it from the beginning. And then I decided after my high school to do a cooking education in France. And then I became familiar with cooking, and I liked the food industry in general. And also my first job was in an Italian pasta company. And then later I moved into the hotel business. So I was always related to food in a certain way. And then after my MBA at Kellogg in the US, I joined Froster initially in Poland, where we took over a factory from Unilever and started to launch the Froster brand in Eastern Europe.
And my understanding from having talked to you before is that experience wasn't quite what you imagined it to be as far as the food goes and your passion for food and the way you look at food. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. Initially, I was quite shocked about what I saw when I came to Froster, because what we had mostly was food technologists or even food chemists who are working, and then very few chefs, actually, almost no chef. And then at the same time, it was also very surprising that nobody from all of our employees, we are about 1,500 people, was actually eating our own food. So that was in the year 2000 when I have joined Froster.
And it's probably not an exceptional situation, or would you say that Froster was particularly quote-unquote bad when it came to the ingredients or the quality of its food?
No, that was actually also at that time really the standard in the food industry, and we used to go every year to our clients, and then we had our so-called annual talks, and when our salespeople came back from these annual talks, they were told by the trade that it should get a little bit cheaper. They sent a briefing to the food chemists and the food technologists, and then with the help of a lot of food additives, they were starting to modify, or how we called it, optimize the product. But it was not really optimization, but it was rather making them a little bit cheaper and replacing actually real ingredients, natural ingredients, with food additives. So, you know, you can easily add a cheese aroma instead of real cheese, or you can also add any kind of taste enhancers, and then take some real natural ingredient out to save some money. And that is what we did over many years. And in the end, we came to the point where even ourselves, we didn't really eat our food anymore.
And my understanding, looking into this a little bit, is that even things called cream or described as cream, for example, might have not natural cream in them. On the other hand, there's nothing illegal about it either. And in many cases, the ingredients can be natural, but they're not cream. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, what you can actually do is that you can also cream, for example, has a lot of different ways. You can use real cream, fresh cream, but you can also use powder. So this is a cream that has been treated with a lot of heat, a lot of other influences that actually make it taste not natural anymore. And this kind of cream powder works much better with machines. So what we were saying actually, that our food at the time was made in a way that the machines can easily produce it and cheaply produce it, but it was not made in the way that people would actually like to eat it.
Right.
And it was also not made in the way that you would actually cook at home. And then, in addition to all that, you can add a lot of additives to make the cream more simple to use for the production. So you can add, for example, a food additive that is called carrageen. So carrageen avoids, you know, that the cream is getting on the top a bit more creamy and on the bottom a bit more light. So that's with natural cream what happens, because the fatty ingredients go up and the other ingredients, they stay down. So this kind of naturalness of the cream you can avoid by adding the food additive carrageen. But that's not a natural ingredient, and it doesn't make the cream taste better, rather the opposite.
Right.
But it makes it easier to work for the machine.
Right, which brings us actually then back to Froster and the mission, because you set out on a mission. And as we had talked about this before, two things come in, which I think would be great if you could explain, which is grandma comes in, and you already mentioned her, I think. And the German Reinheitsgebot, which has something to do with beer. Can you tell us how the new Froster vision, grandma, and the Reinheitsgebot fit together?
Yeah, very good. So the grandma is actually, it was always our, let's say, goals, because we are thinking, and we're always coming from the tradition of cooking. When you think about it, cooking and traditional cooking has a very long history in all countries in the world. So there were basically, when you look at the typical classical cuisines, also in France or Italy, then three points always come to your mind. First of all, the recipes are rather cheap, not very expensive, so that large amount of people can actually afford. Second would be that the product and the food is healthy. And third, that the food tastes good. So when you look, for example, at a classical bœuf bourguignon in France, then this is a rather cheaper part of the beef. It's very tasty, and it's also very healthy, because this kind of meat is actually very low in fat and has a lot of very healthy nutritions. So the classical cuisine, good taste, healthiness, and then also not too expensive. for us was actually a good benchmark for all what we wanted to do in Frosta. So that was the grandmother side, and we were looking at that kind of traditional food preparation and wanted to copy it into our production. The Reinheitsgebot is another interesting thing. That is what happened 500 years ago in Germany. Most people know about the German beer, and there was actually 500 years ago in the beer industry a phenomena where beer producers and brewers started to use additives to make the beer hold longer so that you can keep it for a longer period of time, and that they would also add colorants and different kind of things so to make the beer look nicer and so on. When that happened, the Bavarian court realized that the direction is not going in a good direction, and they should have a law that makes sure that the quality stays at a high level for the German beer, and they invented and called it the Reinheitsgebot, which translated means something like purity law. So the beer producers were 500 years ago all obliged to follow this Reinheitsgebot, and we looked at ourselves and we thought this is a bit similar to what happened in the food industry, because food producers started to use all these additives, and we said this is not the way to make food taste better, rather the opposite. And we said, okay, we will also now introduce our own Reinheitsgebot for our Frosta meals.
So the easy summary would be you went about to do that, but I know it wasn't easy. Can you describe to us some of the key barriers or challenges that you faced in introducing this purity law?
Okay, all of the additives that we saw, about 150 additives that we used at the time, between aroma, taste enhancer, colorants, preservatives, we canceled them. We changed all our recipes. We talked to all our ingredient and raw material suppliers, and we said we do not want you to use any of these kind of things anymore. And if you cannot change it, then we will not buy from you anymore. And this process took us about 2 years, because we had to really go to each of our supplier. We had to change our processes, our machines, and so on. And after the 2 years, we came out with half of the assortment only, but of course with products that were fantastic, and we believed now we will have a great success.
Now that is a price to pay, literally. I mean, reducing your assortment by half, I imagine, has an impact on sales. Did you take up price as well, which would probably have an additional impact on sales?
Yes, exactly. The products that became about 20-30% more expensive. So that's really only 20-30 euro cents at the time, but still, you know, in the quite price sensitive market here in Germany, it was quite a big step for us. And it was actually very much difficult to convince our retailers to accept our new purity Reinheitsgebot meals.
Right. Actually, if I remember right, I read about a very significant breakdown of sales and the share price, etc. I mean, did you ever wonder whether you made the right choices there, or was it clear that this was going to be short term and you would have a turnaround?
Yeah, exactly. The thing was that when we launched in 2003, then we were all very enthusiastic. We worked on it for over 2 years. And then we said, okay, now we start 1st of January, and then we were producing a lot of product just to make sure that we could, fulfill all these orders which would come in. And then the opposite was the case. You know, we did not manage to convince our retailers, and also many of our consumers suddenly saw our products at a much higher price, and they did not immediately understand what does that mean now and what's different in Frosta, because of course we had advertising and we wrote it big on the packaging, but you know, people still saw Frosta and did not really recognize very quickly that we were suddenly something completely different. And in that moment we lost about 50% of our sales, although we believed that the opposite would actually happen. So that was very, it was a real disaster, of course. We had to to lay off some people. We made about 10 million euro losses at the time, and we did not really see how that problem will be solved. So, you know, we had a really dramatic 2003, and fortunately, only at the time I can say that we did not change our direction. We said, okay, it didn't work as we expected, but then we took a lot of initiatives and discussed a lot what to do at the time.
And what made you persevere, I mean, in the face of a 50% breakdown in sales, which is more than significant, what gave you confidence to stick with that direction, or was there simply no other choice at that point?
You know, the good thing was that so many employees, so many people have worked on it, and that we were generally very convinced still about the direction, because suddenly we really realized that the product was so much better. They were tasting more natural, they were tasting much better. So it was a really, from the product perspective, a very clear and good decision that we took. And then, speaking to many consumers, what we realized that the different concept and the different quality, of course, were not immediately realized by the people. So we realized that, you know, we had this imagination that people would immediately understand what we are doing. That kind of immediate expectation we had did not work, and it took much, much longer for consumers, for millions of consumers, to understand that Froster stands for something totally different now. So we realized that we have to give it more time, and we also realized that the story itself was a bit complicated, but because not so many people at the time were talking about food additives, it was nothing very critical. People really didn't care a lot about food at this time still, and there was not a lot of discussion. So what we realized that we have to give it more time, we have to reduce our expectations, and then we also have to communicate much better with the end consumer. And we started, for example, something that at the time, it was in 2003, 2004, when there was no Facebook yet, we started, for example, a company blog. So we announced all of the background information about our brand transformation, about the ingredients, and we gave also consumers the possibility to talk to us so they could write whatever comment they would write to us, even if they were critical. It was immediately online, visible by all others. And there was a lot of much more direct reaction and direct contact to the consumer. And I think all these initiatives helped actually to make our products better known, and also this concept of Reinheitsgebot to make it more clear. Obviously, also the media heard about the big failure, and you know, the newspapers, they usually prefer to write about failures than about successes. So in a certain sense, you know, the bad news at the time even helped us to get some attention by the media, and over the next 2 years until 2005, more or less, we recovered from the initial loss of 50%.
I find it a very interesting case study, because for once here we have an example where you're established and you start out with a consumer that are not necessarily buying you for the reasons that you then institute as a mission, i.e. good, wholesome, natural food the way it's intended to be, like grandma would cook it. So in a way, you shift the brand while the consumer remains the same for a while. Now, what we observe on brands that are more organically grown, like, let's say, I just talked to Vincent Stanley at Patagonia yesterday. It's a 40-year story of a brand interacting with what we call its Uber target, its fans, its disciples, the people who push that brand forward also in its mission and are perfectly aligned. And so less of a cataclysmic kind of repositioning, but a kind of more organic growth. Did you discover, as you repositioned the brand, a new followership beyond the journalists who were interested in the story? And what does this group of consumers, what role does this group of consumers play today?
Yeah, I think that is a good point. And I think that because of the problem we had initially, we got a lot of sympathy in a way from our consumers. And then we also started to call our consumers rather fans than consumers, you know, because we realized that a lot of people were so happy to suddenly be able to find such a product that is made totally in the same way as they would cook it at home, that they were really talking about it to their friends. And we had really a kind of word of mouth promotion about what we did. And I think that was something that was a bit unexpected. I think it was also helped by the fact that it was so difficult. And I think that a lot of people for the first time also realized that many prepared foods is actually has a lot of these additives inside. And that became much more obvious for many. And then people started to, you know, to research a bit more what they're actually eating. And we started to see a real better informed consumer and a consumer that was actually starting to really look more in detail about what they're eating. And I think that was something for us also surprising. We got like a lot of comments on our websites and it was really surprising and nice to see that we have started some real discussion about all this topic.
I understand you were actually a pioneer in having this kind of transparent blog. I think it was as early as 2003 or something like that, when blogs were really still in their infancy. You also advocate and explain, not only on your website, but also on your packaging. You talk about the Reinheitsgebot on the packaging, and it has kind of a fun but engaging and informative tonality. However, as far as I see here from the US and the internet, I wouldn't describe Frosta as the kind of activist brand taking even a political position, like, let's for example say Patagonia does, since I just talked about them. How do you decide what you're talking, where the limit is? How do you balance that?
Yeah, it's I think of course, you know, we maybe sometimes we have been more active with that, but even in the last months, we did a lot of new things that maybe are not visible from far away. But for example, what we did is that we declared on our packaging all the origins and countries of origin of our ingredients. So today, when you buy paella, for example, then you can read on the back where the rice coming from, where the tomato coming from, where the shrimp coming from. And you can really know the food origin. And I think that is something that usually when you think about food that you buy in the supermarket, even when it's coffee or whatever, you never really know where the coffee comes from. And for a ready meal where you have a lot of ingredients, nobody would tell you where the ingredients come from. And these kind of things, which by law are not required, in our belief, are really important, because people like to know, as much as they buy a jeans, they would like to know where the jeans is made. They would also like to know where the food comes from when they buy it. Mm-hmm. So this is, for example, an initiative that we took, and where we are clearly the first one doing it. And we believe that the law should also oblige companies to declare where the ingredients mm-hmm. come from.
But if I understand you right, your position is, I offer transparency, I offer information, but I will not be political in recommending that one or the other way is better.
Well, you know, it is a bit tricky also, because when you use food additives, you make food cheaper. So, for example, if you replace a strawberry or a raspberry with an aroma, then obviously the ice cream or the yogurt is getting cheaper. Now you can say cheap food is not necessarily bad. You could also say, well, some people, they might prefer to buy a cheaper raspberry yogurt, and why should we be against that? You know, from our perspective, what we are saying, and that is what we are also saying to the politicians, where we are trying to have some influence, to say, make the law in a way that the consumer can easily see if the product uses additives or not. So is, simply said, is this yogurt and the taste in the yogurt coming from real raspberries, or is it coming only a little bit from real raspberries, but 80% from aroma, which cost not even 1% of the real raspberry? So this is what we believe, more transparency. And there we believe the law should be more strict. And that is what we're advocating also. We are trying to, you know, contact ministries. We have meetings, but honestly, we are the only one who wants that, because most of the food industry is rather interested to keep it a bit unclear so that they could benefit from all these additives.
And
so
I have to say,
it's a tough way when you're the only one, you know.
And I have to say, I mean, I was surprised to discover so much about Frosta in terms of all that you proactively do, which you just described, but the very humble attitude and kind of a lot of that happening either in the background or quite silently, you know, on your website, in your conversations, maybe in interviews with the press if you're asked about it. Have you considered, or is it simply not the brands and your character to become more outspoken? I'm thinking of the Ben & Jerry's, or, you know, the Patagonia's, or many of the newfangled brands actually that stand on a soapbox and actually shout out because they say it's our responsibility for people to realize what is going on. Have you considered that, or is that simply not in your nature, or is it not, you think, in your budget? What are the reasons to take this more low-key approach?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think that's something that we could do better. I think we haven't taken that occasion. Also now with the social media, we could be a bit more aggressive. So I think something that, of course, we have to consider, and maybe we can be better in that. Yes, you're right. You know, you have to find a way where on one side, very clear and also maybe a bit aggressive. On the other side, it still should be sympathetic in our way. Mm. You know, if we make ourselves too many enemies, which we already have also inside of the food industry, then that's also sometimes a bit difficult.
Right. You present yourself in many ways as a typical packaged foods player and brand. I'm talking, for example, about the name Frosta, which is not necessarily, let's say, aspirational or indicative of this purity and this kind of very natural stance. Or you do use TV advertisement, and while it's educational, it's still a very conventional tool. And obviously, in terms of your distribution channel, maybe you're chained to it. It is a very traditional grocery distribution channel. Is there maybe a dichotomy, a conflict here between some of the visible experienced elements of the brand, like the name, the advertising, the distribution, and then this very modern, very visionary, forward-looking, and in a way backward forward-looking approach to prepackaged nutrition, which is different from the industrial age food packaging that we've seen in the, you know, 50s, 60s, 70s, and so on?
Yeah, I think the one thing is, you know, that that our channel is, of course, very much related to the supermarket, simply because the frozen food cannot easily be distributed like coffee or like something that has not to be in the frozen segment. And that limits us, of course, from the distribution point of view a bit. And yeah, I think we have to consider that, you know. So we need also our retailers to believe in us and to work with us. And that limits us in a certain way. Yes, you're right.
You do go very far. You mentioned coffee a couple of times. I read that you own your own Ethiopian coffee business. Not only that, you get involved in the business incubator in Ethiopia, where the objective is that Ethiopians are enabled to do food business, not only in the growing, but also in the manufacturing, the packaging, the advertising, and you help them learn that. When might this get too deep? When might this get a distraction from the main business. Is that a concern? How do you find the limits, how far you can go in getting involved in trying to push for transparency in using natural products, in securing your own sourcing? Is there some kind of a rule that you set for yourself, or is it a constant trial and error?
No, I think, you know, when we see certain things that that are not working in the right direction, for example, when it comes to these food additives where we believe it is actually bad for people to eat too much of these additives, and that, you know, we should rather benefit from the long and proven history of good food and traditional cooking methods, then I think that is a concern for us. And then we are saying, okay, let's make sure that, you know, we convince as many people as possible about it, and let's explain people about these developments. You know, when you think about it, food additives, they exist for only 50 years, and they have not really proven in the long run that they are really helpful for humans. And we even started a small museum here in Hamburg where we are saying food additives belong to the museum and not into food, because they should rather be history. But, you know, these kind of activities we are doing because we are really believing in them. And similar is for what you said about the coffee. So the coffee law was that we were, or we are still importing raw green coffee to the Western countries, and there's no custom duty. But until 2008, there was a 30% custom duty on manufactured coffee in the countries of origin where the coffee comes from. So we actually made sure that we get cheap raw material to Western countries, but that we do not let the people at the origin benefit from the value addition of their own coffee. So we saw these kind of things, which are in a way also reasons for what we see now with the refugees, when people cannot sell their product and their work, and then when they can only be in agriculture, then they don't like to have that, and then they are moving out of their countries and come to Europe. And, you know, these movements are also a result of the wrong policy. So, you know, when we see these kind of things, we like to take some actions and help a bit to avoid such bad developments.
So
I think, you know, we do that as much as we can and as good as we can. We are not always perfect, of course.
So some would call it idealistic and a cost to the business, but you might also, and it sounds like you also see it as an important investment into the future, into a better future, maybe a little bit or to a large extent for everyone, not just the Frosta brand, but an important investment. We're already running out of time. Unfortunately, this is a very exciting conversation. But before we leave, I wanted to ask you about your vision for Frosta and maybe for the industry in total. Where do you see yourself in 10, 20 years from now as a Frosta brand? What would be your vision of what has happened with the brand and with how we eat?
Yeah. First of all, we, of course, want the Frosta brand to be more active also in many other countries. So we have just moved into Italy, and then we are thinking about new countries, of course. And at the same time, the hope is that, you know, with our actions, we will convince people or even politicians to change the law into a more transparent law where consumers have an easier way to really understand what they are buying and what they are eating. Today, it is really still difficult for consumers to find out. You have to be almost a scientist, or at least, you know, Google and research to understand what is written on the ingredient list and what can be hidden on the ingredient lists. And all of this, in our opinion, is still not very good. And step by step, you know, we see that with a new generation that is much more critical also against big brands and against, you know, traditional ways of doing business, with this new generation, we see that they actually go into our direction and understand what we are doing. And we hope that in 10 years from now, there will be many more.
And Felix, if people are excited about what Frosta is doing, what's the best way of getting in touch with the Frosta brand?
Well, you know, we have info@frosta.de. That's one way, but we're also very active on Facebook, for example, or Instagram. Whenever you send us a message there, then we for sure will respond and connect to you.
Well, Felix, this was excellent and really interesting. Thanks so much for taking the time out of a super busy day.
Thanks a lot to you.
And you, dear listener, you can always reach us, of course, and that is at info@überbrands.com, which is spelled with a U-E, as it should be. Tell us if you like the show. Tell your friends if you did. Like us, subscribe us. You know the spiel, and we all hope to hear you again very soon. Thanks a lot. Tschüss. Bye-bye.